are listening to The Retirement Conversation, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join Joe and Dennis and learn from leading experts in the field, as well as the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our free workbook, access other free tools and resources, and learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to today's Retirement Conversation with our guest, Dawn Carr. Dawn is an associate professor at Florida State University in the Department of Sociology and faculty associate at Pepper Institute for Aging and Public Policy. Dawn's expertise lies in understanding the factors that bolster older adults' ability to remain healthy and active as long as possible. Her recent work focused on understanding the complex pathways between health and active engagement during later life, including the impact of key transitions in health, productivity, and caregiving. Before joining Florida State University in 2016, she was a researcher at the Stanford Center on Longevity. Carr received her PhD in social gerontology and master's in gerontological studies at Miami University and a Bachelor of Arts in music performance at Arizona State University. Dawn, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your bio?
No, that's pretty extensive. Thanks.
So, Dawn, before we talk about your research, how did you become interested in gerontology?
You might have heard on that bio that I have a bachelor's in music performance, which might be a non-traditional pathway to studying aging. But I started off as an orchestral trumpet player and had an injury from a dental surgery, having my wisdom teeth pulled, that caused damage to the nerve in my bottom lip. So I had to find a new career path after kind of being in the direction of planning to be a musician the rest of my life. And to be honest, my interest in aging came kind of by accident. My husband had a job at Miami University. We moved there in 2001, and I was suddenly facing this need for a new career. Ended up meeting the faculty in that program. It turns out to be one of the top academic programs at Miami University. And I was just really taken with what they had to say about aging, and it just felt like a really good fit. And the more I learned, the more excited I got about all the important things that we needed to understand better about older populations and about older people, and just really couldn't stop learning. And I'm still there.
Great to hear. Thank you for sharing that. And in looking at your recent research on cognitive function in aging, what effect might retirement have on our brains?
I think when we think about the effect of retirement on our brains, you first have to sort of think about how does work affect our brains? Because when we're working, we're using our brains in pretty extensive ways, depending on the kind of work that we're doing. We're regularly engaging with people. We're thinking about solving important problems. We're writing, and maybe we're calculating problems in some way for people who do sort of accounting or work with numbers. There's a lot of tasks in our everyday life, and it takes up a good chunk of our life. So when we retire, you can sort of think about what's left in our daily activities is like, what are we doing now with those 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day that are no longer being spent in that way? And so retirement might be something for some people that seems like a relief from a very challenging job in some ways. And maybe that's good because it could be good for our stress and it might give us more space. We might be able to sleep in. But, you know, I think what's important to recognize is that retirement is really now the absence of what was a job. And so how we use our time really matters. So it could be good for us on the one hand, and it might be bad for us on the other if we use our time in ways that are detrimental to how our brain works.
And it's interesting, many people say that they want to work longer today. I've seen as high as 70% in some studies and surveys. What have you found out about the different types of jobs and how that interacts with cognitive functioning?
The working longer, I think that the extent to which people are interested in working longer is related to a few things. One is the type of work that people are doing, they're more capable of working longer. And when you say longer, what do you mean by longer? Well, we think about retirement in this sort of arbitrary 65, age 65, and that's based on oftentimes this notion that that's when you get Social Security or that's when you're supposed to. But actually, people have been retiring younger and younger through the 90s, and then recently it's bumped up a little bit, but people are still retiring on average before they even reach age 65, except for some groups. So some groups are continuing to work past 65 and maybe as late as 70 or beyond. But one of the things that we've discovered in this recent research that I conducted with my colleagues from when I was at Stanford, it started then, and we completed this research after I arrived here at Florida State, is that the type of work that people are engaging in influences whether or not that has an effect on the brain. That is, does working longer help people maintain their brain function better, depending on the kind of work that they have done over their career? And what we determined, or what we discovered through this research, we were looking at a nationally representative sample of older adults, and we were looking at different pathways out of work. So some people continue to work full time, and then alternatively, some people just stop working and never go back. But there's a growing number of people in the last 10 years, it's actually more than half. Even if they leave work, they continue to engage in some kind of work, either part-time or they go back to work in some way and continue to stay engaged in the workforce. And for people who have jobs where what we'd kind of described as they're not very cognitively complex. So we looked at a variety of characteristics that sort of identify jobs and put them into different boxes. And we identified those with low cognitive complexity, those with moderate levels of cognitive complexity, and those at high levels of cognitive complexity. And what we discovered is for the people with low levels of cognitive complexity, when they retired, they experienced a big hit to their cognitive function. And that even exists if they go back to work in some way. So that return to work doesn't have the kind of buffer to their cognitive function that you might hope for. Now, if they continue to work full time, they seem to be able to maintain their cognitive function quite well for quite a while. That doesn't seem to be the case for people with more complex jobs. And you might think of someone like I mentioned somebody who works with numbers. So an accountant, for example, who has on a regular basis has to use their brains in ways that they have to solve problems, work with people, and be able to calculate complex formulas on a regular basis every day. The people in those kinds of jobs have a tendency to be able to maintain their cognitive function regardless of whether they leave work. And this is a really interesting finding because it seems to be the case that they have either some sort of accumulated cognitive reserve where over time maybe they've been able to maintain function so their brains have the ability to kind of handle this loss of daily challenge that their work provided, or perhaps when they leave work, they're doing some other type of activity that is sufficiently engaging to their brain that helps them maintain that function.
You mentioned the daily challenges of work. Why is challenging our brains good for us?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. One of the things that recent research has shown, and using, you know, we have much better technology available now to kind of understand how brains work. And in recent years, there's a group of scientists who've been looking at functional MRI, where they're looking at how the brains work when faced with different kinds of tasks. And they've sort of been able to determine that we developed this sort of what we call cognitive scaffolding. And with regular engagement, we build networks, these what we call neural networks in the brain. And so by regularly being challenged, our brains have to work and make more connections. Over time, this accumulates and provides a kind of cognitive scaffolding that we can rely on when there are other problems that our brains might face. And that might even be later on when we're faced with things that might cause dementia. And so the people with these more sophisticated networks in their brains are able to sort of compensate when some bad things happen. So you can sort of think, well, one pathway, like you're taking a road and there's a roadblock there, people with more complex cognitive scaffolding can have another road that they can take for a detour and still be able to handle different tasks. And people who haven't accumulated that kind of cognitive scaffolding may be unable to handle it. If there's a roadblock, it might just end. They might not have an alternative pathway. And so their ability to continue to perform complex tasks are more challenging because they lack that kind of resiliency. What researchers have discovered is in later life, it's helpful to challenge our brains because it maintains that scaffolding. And there's some controversy around how much we can actually do with the brain. In other words, can you just play, you know, one of these video games to kind of keep your brain active and that's going to work? Well, there's pretty clear evidence that if there is much benefit, it isn't significant enough to warrant encouraging people to sit in front of video games instead of doing other activities. But actually, the benefits also come from a lifetime of exposures. Just like our health, we can't, you know, eat donuts every day until we're 50 and then go, oh, maybe I should stop eating donuts and I'm going to start exercising and suddenly the effects of those 50 years of donuts are going to go away. They're still there. We can still recover some, but we accumulate the effects of our health behaviors throughout the duration of our lives. And when we reach later life, we're coming to the table with a certain, you know, in this case, a brain that's been influenced by all kinds of different things. And so in the research that we do, we're kind of taking people at that starting place, knowing that they've had a lifetime of experience. And so when we reach later life, we can't go back and fix what's already happened, but we can kind of do our best to maintain what's there for as long as possible. And challenging our brains can help us do that. But I guess the main takeaway is it's good to challenge our brains for the duration of our life, not just wait until we need it because we're worried we're going to get dementia, you know.
Great point. Just in time does not work in all things. Right now, my brain is stuck on the phrase 50 years of donuts, but that's a visual.
And video games.
Right.
not in your case.
So I want to go back to something you said, if it's okay, about the different pathways. And one in particular I'm curious about. We've seen that about 20 to 25% of people are unretiring within the first 5 years or so. And what impact might returning to the workforce have on cognitive function?
In the research that we did with this study that I conducted with my colleagues at Stanford, what we found is for these people with the more cognitively complex jobs, going back to work after having a break was associated with an improvement in cognitive function. And we don't typically see that sort of thing. And there isn't other research that's really looked at this. So I'm not quick to say, oh, everybody should quit work and then go back to work so they can improve their brains. But I think what we're observing is potentially this effect where going back to work when you have certain skills and abilities, you might be going back to work in challenging jobs where you are learning new things and your brain is able to respond in a really positive way, building new connections through learning in this later period of life. And so going back to work seems to be really beneficial for people with this type of career path who come to the table in this way. Now, the problem is this doesn't seem to be across the board. It seems to benefit people with moderate and high levels or be associated with beneficial effects for people with moderate and high levels of cognitive complexity. But those who have jobs that are lower in cognitive complexity before they retire, when they go back to work, there isn't an effect that we observe for them. And, you know, so I don't actually think it's because it's not beneficial for their cognitive function. I suspect that the type of work that's available for them is not potentially the kind of work that provides that kind of stimulation that is needed to really challenge the brain and help it maintain function. This is not something our research was able to look at, but something we sort of would guess and future research would look at more carefully. But for now, our findings suggest that going back to work is potentially quite beneficial for people with moderately and highly cognitively complex jobs who are going to go back and maybe come refreshed, maybe a little, you know, take a little time to de-stress and change directions and maybe engage in a new job that's quite meaningful. a lot of times people lately are going back to work that in jobs that mm-hmm. some people call encore careers, where you're doing this sort of serious career for a long time, and now they're going back to work in something that they always wanted to do and maybe doesn't pay as well, but is really important to them and they're really excited about. And I think there's growing evidence that people in a position to take those kinds of transitions really benefit greatly.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. How about different ways of retiring more gradually, more slowly, like part-time work or even phased retirement?
Yeah, I think that this is the direction of the future. I'd like to believe that it is, because I think for a lot of people, this has potential to be very beneficial. So just in terms of our lifestyles, it's a very stressful thing to retire. Now, people say, oh, I can't wait. I'm so excited. I just can't wait to not have to go to work every day. But our work world, our work lifestyle is one that's been there for most people for many decades. It's our social network. It gives us a sense of meaning and purpose in our daily activities. It gives us a sense of challenge, of something to accomplish, and it provides clear structure in our daily activities. So if we go from one day working full-time after decades to another day not doing anything, this could be really disruptive in lots of ways. Losing those social connections very suddenly, even if you were friends with your kind of friends with the people at work, you don't have those same daily interactions. And that can be tough for social engagement. So figuring out what kind of social needs we have, which is really important, both for our brains and our health in lots of ways. And then just getting up and going to work, we have to move physically. There's a certain amount of physical activity required, and certainly the amount of brain activity that we engage in on a daily basis will change. And so if we suddenly spend our days literally replacing work with TV watching, well, that wouldn't be good. You know, we're socially isolated, we're not using our brains, and we have no structure. It's just the television. That would be terrible. And a lot of people who do retire, that becomes a really important part of their daily activities is television watching. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's quite detrimental to our well-being. You can just tell by these alternative things being much better. Being sedentary and socially isolated is generally not good. So moving into retirement more slowly, I think, has potential to give people a little bit of space that they're looking for. I think when we get to a certain phase of our life, we might have some health problems that we're struggling to meet. We might have to see a doctor regularly for high blood pressure or some really manageable conditions, but a full-time work schedule might make it more challenging to fit in those kinds of needs. Maybe we want to spend more time with family members or have some space to cultivate some hobbies. And I think part-time work provides this opportunity to do that without taking away some of the beneficial aspects of our, you know, that work offers in terms of daily structure and engagement and challenge. And frankly, we rest a lot of our sense of self on the activities we engage in at work. Our sense of identity is largely shaped by our work lives. You know, people talk about and think about their self-worth oftentimes, for better or worse, based on the kind of work that they do. And so it's very protective of maintaining that identity and, again, keeping this sense of purpose and structure to life. Unfortunately, though, there isn't a lot of opportunity for that. People are kind of figuring it out. Some people are working for themselves to maintain that. So there is a kind of a bigger proportion of older adults who work as entrepreneurs or are self-employed. I think for this reason, they want to maintain some level of engagement, but there isn't a lot of part-time work available in that regard. So I think as we look to the future, and many people, experts have been saying for quite a while that there's likely to be a real problem with not having enough people in the workforce due to population aging, and helping maintain the expertise and the wisdom of older workers in the workforce could benefit work environments greatly. So I think there's room to start cultivating meaningful part-time jobs for older workers who want to make that transition. And I think it's really a direction that we need to be more cognizant of, and not just cognizant, but also very planful in terms of thinking about how do we create non-full-time career paths. So I think this is a really important area of focus, and I'm hoping that there's greater attention to that. And again, not just for these very privileged workers who might have more options and might be able to say, hey, I only want to work 2 days a week. And they're like, great, we really value you. We're going to keep you. A lot of people aren't in that position. They really want to make this transition. It's simply not available. So I think this is an area that different firms and organizations around the country need to be thinking really hard about.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. It's a win-win all around, potentially. I was wondering if I could ask about another part of your research. Mm-hmm. In 2017, you co-authored an interesting study on the use of technology among older adults. What were the key findings there?
I think first it's important to think about, it's useful to think about later life in different phases. I think we often think about just once you reach, let's say, this special magical age of 65, everything after 65 is the same. You know, it's just old age. But these issues I was just talking about with regard to older workers is really about the people in those early phases of later life. And this is a period where we're more likely to be healthy and more active. The study that we did on technology use, we were interested in the group that comes after that. And that's the fastest growing proportion of older adults, which is those who are 80 and older. And my colleagues at Stanford were interested in better understanding whether or not they're using technology in some way and how that use of technology is affecting their lives. And so you don't often think about 80-year-olds using computers and balancing their checkbook online. But in fact, those were the kinds of questions we were interested in learning about. We collected data on a national sample of 80-year-olds, and a very large proportion of people in this population are using some kind of technology on a regular basis. And what we were curious about is whether or not it had a positive effect on their life. One of the challenges, particularly in this phase of life, is social isolation. Oftentimes, by the time we're in our 80s, we're losing a spouse, we've lost friends. We're often not in a position physically to be able to get out and about and go meet people in the same way that we did in our earlier years. And so one of the things we were curious about is whether technology might be able to bridge that gap in some way. And what we discovered is that people who are using technology for the purposes of social interaction and social engagement were benefiting in terms of their health and well-being. And those who are using technology in other ways, they weren't experiencing any detriment, but they weren't experiencing any benefit either in terms of their health and well-being. So using technology to help bolster social connections seems to be a really beneficial way to use technology. So calling someone on a phone is a great way to use a phone. Using your iPad to Skype your grandchild in later life seems to be beneficial to well-being. And that's pretty logical, but we were really encouraged by the fact that this age group was experiencing benefits.
And Dawn, what advice would you offer people about how to stay sharp?
You know, there are lots of ways that I think you can keep your brain active. At first of all, I think we can't just, again, think about this as something that happens once we're older and worrying that we're losing our cognitive function. I think that our brains, again, have been affected and are affected by our activities across the life course. And what we know is that there are three really important ingredients for maintaining cognitive function, not just in later life, but across our lives. And one is staying physically active. The blood flow in our brains are affected by physical activity, and we know that this has a beneficial effect on cognitive function. And the more regularly we stay engaged in physical activity and avoid sedentary behavior, this seems to be very beneficial. So you don't think about staying mentally sharp by exercising, but there's a certain amount of evidence that suggests that just continuing to stay physically active matters. The second maybe surprising thing that we know in research about maintaining cognitive function is the importance of social interactions. People who have very active social lives are able to keep their cognitive function longer. So they're able to not only arrive in later life with higher levels of cognitive function, but they also seem to maintain it longer if they continue to stay socially active. And by that, it means having people in our lives that we can call if we, you know, it's a problem in the middle of the night and we just have to call someone and get help. knowing that we have someone there, that's usually a sign that we have a social life with meaningful connections and people we can rely on a regular basis. But not just that, but doing activities that regularly involve being with other people. So what we call socially integrated, and leading these socially integrated lives is beneficial. The last thing would be more obvious to a lot of people, which is staying cognitively active. Although this isn't my area of research, I understand that there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that learning a new language has been shown to be beneficial mm-hmm. for maintaining cognitive function longer. And I think it's representative of the larger goal here of what we know, which is to continue to challenge our brains. Watching television, a TV show that doesn't involve any kind of thinking, let's say just a regular, you know, sitcom, probably doesn't do much for stimulation of the brain, but maybe reading a book or a biography or going to a museum or taking classes at a university. There are a variety of ways that we can challenge our brains, from small tasks to bigger tasks, that there seems to be growing evidence is beneficial for just sort of buffering some of the normal aspects of aging and how aging affects our brains, particularly in the later phases of old age. So staying physically active, being socially engaged, and maintaining an active cognitive engagement in life are really probably the best areas to focus on.
I think those are wonderful tips. And there's an implied balance in here. Specifically, I appreciate the physical activity piece. When people do something physically, there's a sense of it clears your mind, helps you think better and everything. And I think the connection here is really strong. Thanks for that, Dawn.
Absolutely.
So Dawn, how can people best follow your work going forward?
That's a good question. Well, I probably should be better at Twitter. I'm working on this.
It's very intellectually challenging, by the way.
Yeah, there we go. I think that's what I need to do. This is my task, is to start. I told a colleague just last week that I need Twitter training. So yes, I have a Twitter account. I'm hoping I can be better about using it. At my university, I have interviews quite often on the radio, and I actually, on my drive into the office today, was listening to myself on the radio. I do have some things online there as well. So if you're curious about that, you can look there as well. I have a website, and probably those are the best places to find my work.
Great. And we'll include links to those for listeners in the show notes. And Dawn, thank you so much. This is going to be very helpful to many people. So thank you for taking the time to do it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawn.
It's a great conversation with Dawn Carr. We appreciate her taking the time to do this. Dennis, what were some of the takeaways that you highlighted?
Yeah, absolutely. Dawn was great and was a great guest today. We appreciate that. I learned something today. I learned about this concept of cognitive scaffolding, which I thought was fascinating me. I learned that challenging ourselves helps build a strong network in our brains and helps us handle more difficult tasks. And while that seems intuitive in some ways, the research that she had was very interesting on that and made a connection with me, clearly. So challenging our brains is very good, as she highlighted. Also, what you do throughout your life matters, but there's no better time to start but now if you haven't. So I think that's the first point. Second point is she talked about the different ways of retiring more slowly. And she highlighted many areas that we see that change when people leave work, some of them very significantly. To name a few, social networks, your meaning and purpose that you get from working, your self-worth, your personal identity, challenges that you get every day, and the structures that work gives you kind of to live your life a certain way, right? It could be a stressful time, and going more slowly into retirement or into this next part of your life and giving yourself some space can be very positive. Considering part-time work offers you some of these benefits that you get from work and also can help you balance other parts of your life. So if you're working part-time or something, you may have time for hobbies, you may have time to take care of your family, spend more time in social networks. So going slowly and being involved in part-time work can actually be very fulfilling for you. I would add that building a plan for doing this can be very helpful. It's likely not to happen automatically. Those are my 2 points. Joe, what about yourself?
I had a few things. It was a great conversation. A lot of things jumped out. The first one to me is really just to reframe how people think about retirement, meaning it's easy to think about the relief, as she highlighted, that people think about by stopping working.
But you have to remember that there's a longer term story here and to think about the different phases of later life and that there are things you can do in the early phase that will help you in later phases. So I think broadening that out is very, very helpful. And to really be thinking, as you said, about how do you replace some of the things that you get from work beyond a paycheck. Second, how multifaceted it is in terms of maintaining cognitive function. There's no silver bullet. And it's a combination of things that she recommends: physical activity, lifelong learning, which can continue to develop new neural pathways and connections, and really the social interaction part, but also staying, if it's something you want to do, in the game of work, through some type of work, especially ones that are either, as she said, complex or meaningful. And I thought it was great that you mentioned the Encore Careers, which we work with a number of people on, where you can do work that has a different purpose than perhaps your other work, but still can be helpful in that way. And third thing is to really be thinking about some of the specific things that she mentioned that are accessible to many, if not most of us. And things like reading, going to museums, taking a class at university, all things that are steps you can take to start. So planning's good, but even just starting may lead you into a deeper engagement with something you like to do and that's good for you in this way. And then finally, I think, as you talked about, the exploring different pathways to and from work to retirement, as opposed to the cliff model where Monday, I'm retired. And here we go. So we now know not to use that data to eat donuts. But beyond that, I think what she said was really helpful is really explore ways to stay engaged work or return to work if that's something you want to do. And the one I always highlight is phased retirement. Only 9% of companies have formal programs for reasons of the benefits programs and other legal issues. But you can often negotiate some type of arrangement either with the company you work for in many cases or explore part-time opportunities with other organizations at different junctures when you're ready for that and the benefits work on your side. So I think being open to that, and I think I agree with her, that is the future for various reasons, including demographics you cited. But I think also the type of work that's being done now, and I think the lifestyle benefits that flexibility offers. This is the generation that was on the forefront of alternative work arrangements. I mentioned to a number of people. When I was 29, we had our first child, and I was in an HR role at my company, and I was pioneering the use of all kinds of things to help working parents, both men and women. And we were fighting up against it at the time, but we put a lot of good things in place. And this is the same generation now that's now in their 60s, and flexible work arrangements now have a different meaning, but they're still as useful and accessible as it can be. It's just not often thought about in terms of retirement.
Let's hope that trend continues and change keeps happening. Yeah. And for the record, Joe's not a donut eater. You're not.
Occasionally.
Occasional donor.
I did grow up in the Boston area where Dunkin' Donuts is king, so you do get exposed to it in your life, but it's not part of my regular staple diet in any way, and nor has it been.
We're all glad to hear that today.
Occasionally.
Thanks for joining us today on The Retirement Conversation. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.